Shane, are you awake there?
I feel like I'm the representative of lazy people, which we're not. We're just differently rhythmed.
So Shane's awake, so am I, and unsurprisingly, I'm hoping that you are too for this edition of Playback Daily with me, Gemma Craddock, on the 3rd of June. And you can look forward to this.
My dream for this book is someone falls in love with the characters I've written and really connects them. And then they go through hell and back with the characters and are sitting on the edge of their seat, gripped as everything falls apart.
And this?
Some come in that are afraid of needles, so you just ease their mind. You know,
well, how would you do with that? Well, yeah. I am afraid of needles.
Yeah, no. I would say to you, I've had it done myself. I hardly felt the needle going in.
And a bit of this.
It's going to be where you're going to be spending most of your time, and put it into a nice room that you're going to enjoy going to. So you can bring up your cup of coffee in the morning, the sun is shining in and it gives you a bit of a lift. You're not thinking, Jesus, I'm at home again today.
So let's get cracking. Early birds, night owls, everyone has their own chronotype. A phrase I learned listening to Claire Byrne last week. But is greeting the dawn with meditation, affirmations and inevitably sea swimming a trend that's here to stay? On Today with Claire Byrne, Shane Hegarty, children's author, was repping the snooze button brigade. I'm a proud member myself. While founder of Mookie and Boo, Susie Beggin, took us through her very early morning routine.
So my day starts at 6 a.m. So I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and start my little morning routine.
And the idea then is you're getting up before your children and you've a little bit of time for yourself.
Yeah, I think how you kind of start your day really sets the tone for your day. It allows kind of control for your day. Prioritizing some time for yourself, for me, just increases my productivity, keeps me really focused. And how I start my day will really kind of determine how my day goes. So I'm really obviously committed to my daily practices and to my daily rituals. And when I do that every day, it really allows me to kind of, you know, not be too stressed or too anxious, and allows me to be organised. And I think when we're organised, our productivity is really high.
Okay. Shane, are you awake there?
I feel like I'm the representative of lazy people, which we're not. We're just differently rhythmed.
Well, what time do you tend to get up at in the morning?
Well, I get up. I mean, the kids are up and getting ready for school, you know, so kind of either side of 8 o'clock would be kind of normal for me.
Ah, that's not too bad. I mean, I thought you were going to tell us you were in the scratcher till 10.
No. But the thing is, it's more just the sunrise thing. I realised that we went through the entire sunrise thing on Instagram and, you know, people getting up and taking pictures and going for swims and things. And I hadn't seen a sunrise outside of Instagram. And then I kind of realised, and I wrote about it recently in the Sunday Times, that I've accepted that I'm just not one of those kind of morning people.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that as the day goes on, then you're a little bit more active towards the later stages, 5, 6, 7 o'clock?
Yeah, I find actually I'm too kind of awake by the time we get to about 8, 9 o'clock. So where there's people who do their exercise first thing in the morning, I tend to do it quite late at night, and I'll go for my run at 9:30, or last night I finished my exercise about 10:15. And what's interesting is you see other people out there who are kind of running in the dark kind of late at night, but you just don't maybe get those kind of pictures on social media, and you don't get that same sense. I think it's a slightly, maybe we don't feel, or society kind of cherishes it, maybe rightly so, people who get up and at it first thing in the morning. But there are those of us who are still dragging through the day late at night.
Do you not find, though, if you do that, if you exercise late, that you just can't, I mean, you can forget about going to sleep for hours after that?
No, I find that it kind of wipes me out properly.
Okay.
And then I just kind of restart the next day. And it takes about 2 or 3 hours to wake up. But, you know, gradually, like a kind of an old car, you know, gradually you give the key a few turns, it eventually gets going.
You see, Susie, there are early morning people, and there are people who are better late at night than night owls. Do you accept that?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, of course. That's, you know, that's just the way people are programmed. But for me, I think developing that morning ritual is just fundamental to my overall well-being. And I think as a mom as well, it's really important because, you know, I have 3 kids. And when you become a mom, you get very used to those early mornings. You know, when you have a baby, obviously, your lack of sleep is huge. So for me, prioritizing sleep is a huge thing. So I just couldn't get my head around exercising late at night. I mean, when you're going out for your run, Shane, I'm getting ready to go to bed, you know, so... Yeah, everybody has different things that work for them. But just for me, I think the morning and that ritual of the morning and kind of starting off your day in that way is just fundamental to how I live. You know, it's really important to me. So.
Would you recommend to Shane that he gives it a go?
Absolutely. But I think, like Shane said, I mean, everybody is programmed differently and different things work for different people. But for me, I think if you start your morning in the right way, it really kind of sets that tone of calm. And I think it actually gives you more energy. It builds focus. You know, when you have that routine in the morning, and if you do these kind of daily rituals, they're very meaningful practices, and they're very internally motivated. And I think it reduces your stress, it reduces your anxiety. You feel much more organized, and with that organization, you know, you're much less overwhelmed, I think, going into your day.
Mm-hmm. Shane, what do you think? Would you be prepared to give it a shot?
I do have ambition. I've always had ambitions to give it a shot. And I do. My wife is fantastic. She gets up early for work. She gets up early and she will have had her run before often I get out of bed. So it's not as if it's an alien concept. Like the rest of the house is busy and up and at them. And my son swims first thing in the morning. But I think maybe over the years, I found that when I've the ambition has not always necessarily been met with the practice. And that I just find that when I get up early in the morning, despite all these kind of good intentions, I am wiped by the time I get to about 4 o'clock. So I tend to kind of backload the day, and I've just settled into that rhythm. And some reason, it works. We can be, us late risers can be productive members of society, I think, I hope. Yeah,
do you not find, though, that you wake early anyway in the summer?
No, I'll sleep through pretty much anything if we have the opportunity.
That's a great skill, you know, because there are times when I think, well, I'm an early riser anyway, but you'd love a lie in, and I find it impossible if the sun is streaming in through the curtains. Just not going to happen.
Yeah, no, it's years of practice. I think you do have to be dedicated to finding that opportunity for a lie in, and maybe it's not for everybody, but if you put your mind to it, it can occasionally work out.
I salute you. But Susie, it sounds to me as though you mightn't always have been an early morning person, because you mentioned there that with the arrival of children, the schedule changes a bit. Can you cast your mind back pre-children? Were you somebody who might have stayed in bed a little bit later?
Not necessarily, to be honest. I think before I had my kids in my 20s, I was working really hard. I had a salon in Dublin and I worked like very long hours. So I was kind of always up early, kind of going to work, you know. So, and like you say, the sun, I always woke with the sun. I'm very much on that kind of rhythm of, you know, going to bed when the sun goes down, waking up with the sun. So I think I was always an early riser. But I think when you have your kids, it's more that kind of lack of sleep, and you really learn to kind of prioritise your time and to prioritise your sleep. That's what came to me from being a mom. But I think I was always a girl who got up early, yeah.
And your routine doesn't change? Weekends, holidays, same time?
Always the same. Yeah, always the same. The practices are very, very important to me. So I'm a yoga and meditation teacher. So I think to kind of be there and to be present for my clients. And but, you know, you have to put in these practices and you have to practice them daily. You have to have a committed practice. And you have to, you know, you really have to show up for yourself every morning. It's really important.
So you do your yoga and your breath work, and then do you sea swim as well?
I do. Yeah, I'm very lucky. I live just 800 metres from South Beach in Greystones, and just up the road. So a couple of years ago, I did some courses with Niall O'Murcu into Wim Hof.
We had him on the programme, yeah.
Yeah, he's fantastic. And the benefits, they were huge. And I never swam in the winter until the lockdown. So I would have always swam in the summer, but I was never a winter swimmer. Mm-hmm. And obviously then when lockdown happened, I thought, okay, I'm going to go for it. And it just became part of my daily ritual. And the benefits I felt from it were enormous. And it's just something that I really look forward to now every morning. I love the sea and I love going down. I just feel amazing after it.
Now, Shane, are you tempted at all?
Well, I have to say no. I mean, I do have a lot of admiration for people who get up and do that. And there are some wonderful, you know, there's photographer Ger Holland who takes amazing pictures of the sunrises, and you realise how beautiful it is and quiet at that time in the morning. So I do really appreciate it. But as I said, I think sometimes, and science is great at giving you an excuse sometimes to stay in bed. You know, there are people built differently and feel differently, and science will tell you rightly or wrongly, and I kind of want to believe it, that, you know, people who stay up later are more creative and things like that, and people who get up earlier tend to be more organised and practical. And I can kind of buy into that to an extent. I know a lot of writers who write very, very late at night and kind of use that sort of dark and quiet time, and that's their time. So I suppose I'd be worried that if I go out and everybody else who's normally sort of in bed goes out, that it'll really get too crowded for the people who do like getting up first thing in the morning. So we'll be selfless and let them have that
routine.
Time of the morning.
Well, look, each to their own, I think, is the lesson here.
The circadian rhythm of life. Shane Hegarty and Susie Began on Today with Claire Byrne. Much has been made of the fact that almost 50% of the adult population has had their first jab, and rightly so. But what of these monumental mass vaccine centres that most of us will eventually pass through? On Morning Ireland, Cian McCormick met staff and nervous visitors about to get the jab.
Look, I think it's kind of good to see that it's happening, because obviously it's kind of taken a bit of time to get to this point.
Very nervous, but only because I'm afraid of needles. No, it'd be nice to see friends again. I miss meeting up with my friends.
These are the voices of some of the 1,000 people who get vaccination shots at the Punchestown Racecourse Vaccination Centre most days.
Well, I train racehorses for a living, and it's, you know, when everybody is done, the owners can get back racing again and spectators can get back racing, and it's a huge thing for everybody, really.
As people stream into the Hunt stand registration area.
Hi, sir. How are you there?
I'm met by Ger Pilo, the HSE's General Manager for COVID in Dublin South, Kildare and West Wicklow.
We've just arrived in. It's actually like the arrivals hall of an airport. So what's happening here?
The people are registering and they check that usually with photo ID, passport or driving licence. And then they're put up on the system as arriving. And once they've done that, they go off into the vaccination hall.
The vaccination hall is a short walk, only seconds away. Ger Pilo describes what it looks like.
I suppose it just looks like a whole bunch of small booths in a big, big hall. So there's 20 booths here, all marked.
People are really flying in through here. Can I stop someone on the way in, do you think?
Yeah. They let you.
Sorry, excuse me. I'm just doing a piece for RT Radio.
And one of those people I stop is 49-year-old Mary Flood from Kildare Town.
Well, what does getting the vaccine mean to you today?
Oh, life getting back to normal. I can't wait to be able to meet people and be comfortable when you go out and about.
Mary is nervous of needles, and to help her, there are volunteers like Derek Phelan who gives advice and support.
Some come in that are afraid of needles, so you just ease their mind. You know,
well,
you hardly.
How would you do it now? Well, you're trying to ease me. Yeah. I am afraid of needles.
Yeah, no. I would say to you, I've had it done myself. I hardly felt the needle going in.
I don't like needles, so it's good to know that I won't even feel it.
Well, that's great now. So that's good advice. Why would you volunteer to do something like this?
I was happy to do it. My wife and I do it, and it's our pleasure. Like, I mean, rather than sitting at home, we realise that we can help.
Mary makes her way into one of the 20 vaccination booths.
My name is Bernie, and we're giving you the Pfizer vaccine today, so Great. Do take a seat.
It's where she meets vaccinator Bernie Cotter.
Are you going back to work later?
Yeah.
You are, right?
Yeah.
You
can
get the afternoon off.
No.
Okay.
And how did that feel?
I didn't feel anything. Absolutely nothing. I'm delighted. My father is 86, so he has been vaccinated, but now it's an extra added bonus that I'm vaccinated, feeling more comfortable, been in his company, been in other people's company.
Mary's reaction is typical of what Bernie Cotter has heard over the past number of weeks. Bernie returned to nursing when the pandemic hit, and that move has proved rewarding.
Left nursing to take up a career in journalism. Then when the pandemic hit, I came back to nursing to try and help out. So I'm delighted to be here. There's a sense of people coming in now that they are, you know, getting a chance to reclaim their lives.
This is a massive operation involving HSE staff, administration contractors, vaccinators, doctors, the defence forces, and about 30 volunteers. Maeve Doyle is the clinical lead at the vaccination centre.
It's very successful. Everybody works together as a team. Anyone that comes in, it's a very happy place.
The next stop is the observation area. It's a big room with about 40 people sitting on chairs distanced 2 metres apart.
Really delighted and actually a little bit emotional, I have to say. I've seen both of my parents, 185 and 180, through their vaccinations. So it's kind of nice to be getting mine now as well.
Claire Scully from Wicklow has just received her vaccine.
It's fantastic. you know, I think it's been very tough for everybody, and it feels now like this is the start of maybe better times to come, although I do hope we're not rushing into opening everything up too quickly, because I think the thoughts of being back where we were in January and February would be very difficult for everybody to tolerate.
Claire Scully from Wicklow, ending that report from Kian McCormick on Morning Ireland. Oliver Callan continues his tenure on the Ryan Tuberty Show, and this morning was joined by author Jamie O'Connell to discuss his debut novel, Diving for Pearls. The novel is a thriller that looks at the disparate experiences of immigrants in both Ireland and Dubai, and Jamie began by describing the genesis of the book.
I suppose what kind of set the whole thing off was flying into Dubai, and you're just kind of coming in over the Persian Gulf, this glittering blue sea, and then the plane swerved around over this kind of sandy desert, and there's just this city sitting there in the middle of the desert. And it's not like a Dublin city, like two or three story buildings. We're talking like 70, 80 story skyscrapers of glass and steel. And afterwards, when I thought about it, I was like, what impression did it leave on me? And actually, it was like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz when she sees the Emerald City for the first time, that kind of like right. dazzling city. So for a time, I knew I had to write about it because my background is short stories, but I just couldn't find the story, my way into the city, I suppose. And it was actually reading Colin McCann's book, which was out at the time, Let the Great World Spin, which is his novel set around 1970s New York. And it's a portrait of a city at the time. And I just loved, like, the 70s New York was amazing. It was, you know, Halston, which was on TV recently, sort of Studio 54. It just was a moment in the city that's very special. And for me, I was able to kind of go, well, this was a moment in Dubai when this film star arrived. And I kind of took the inspiration from how he then structured his novel to give a portrait of a city and use that sort of similar structure, these multiple viewpoints then to create Dubai as it appears in the novel.
So it's 2010 in the novel.
2010, November.
We know from recent reeling of the years, this was a pretty grim time in Ireland. People were obviously escaping a recession here, and then you're arriving in this glinting, like it glints with wealth, doesn't it?
Yes, Dubai.
So were you there yourself in that period?
I was, between kind of 2010 and over the next few years. Like, I'm that late millennial age who all kind of graduated at the exact wrong moment. And many of my friends, probably two-thirds of my friends, left Ireland at that time to look. There was nothing going on here. Even myself, I really struggled for a couple of years to kind of find my feet. And Dubai, as much as, you know, we've all seen the news, there's definitely challenges and things as Westerners we find maybe not that, you know, we'd be comfortable about. But it offered refuge to my friends at that time. It was this kind of oasis in the desert. And as much as this book has, like, when things go wrong in Dubai, I also have this other viewpoint that it did give opportunity to people who really needed opportunity. And also, the whole world was in a conversation of negativity. And to land in Dubai, and people are optimistic. They're like, I'm going to make something of my, like, I will work hard and things will go right. You know, that kind of optimism.
And I
think that's such a powerful thing. So I hope the book has a nuance to it, that it's not like Dubai is an awful place, because it isn't. There's a lot about the place that I actually think is great. And I love the optimism. I love the fact that, like, we'll build a skyscraper and it appears, you know, it's kind of, they're very passionate, you know, and but at the same time, going there as a Westerner and as an Irish person, I think actually as well, thinking about our past and immigration and things like that and how we were maybe treated going elsewhere in the 19th century and early 20th century and, you know, kind of discriminated against. I did feel an unease when I landed there and I went into my friend's villa there, and I came with the Barry's tea. We had a cup of Barry's tea, long flight, all the rest of it. And my case had gone upstairs to the room. And then I came upstairs and my clothes were put away. They were all ironed. It was done, like a maid had done it. And I was like, I'm not sure about this. Like, I really feel uncomfortable.
And this is very
this
typical
kind of,
everywhere, for isn't it?
Very, very typical.
Yeah. And the Dubai maids.
But one thing I realized about myself, which made me kind of think about how we approach luxury, and rather than sitting here in Ireland finger wagging about what other people do, is 2 weeks later after I left Dubai and I landed back in Ireland, and my case was full of all moldy old clothes, and I opened my case, like, God, I'd love the maid.
Okay.
So I was like, how quickly we are corrupted by luxury, you know. So,
but we have the Irish guilt thing, don't we?
Yes.
Certainly, like, taxi drivers put luggage into the boot.
Yeah.
There's a great scene because Siobhan, who's one of the young Irish mammy who's living in Dubai, tell us about the Christmas brunch.
Well, the, brunch is the closest thing I can say to that is if you did like the Roman feast in school, you know, the vomitorium and all that, you know, so you just keep eating and eating. So you pay to go into a hotel. It's the Friday brunch. Friday is like the Saturday there. They have a different weekend. And you go in and you pay, I think it's about €200. It's not cheap, but and then you go in and what you have is what they call them kitchens. So you go into this huge hall of like buffet, but not buffet on steroids is the only way to describe it. So you have an English breakfast kitchen and it has, no, English dinner kitchen, sorry. So it'll have everything from Yorkshire puddings through to chicken to beef to thing, everything. You go to the next kitchen, the cheese kitchen, and it will have every kind of cheese. And I mean, cheese that you probably only find in Dingle, you know, that kind of like the, you know, the real cottage cheese. Like, where, how are they even getting this in here?
Yes.
And then you go into the next kitchen, the seafood kitchen, and then you go into the next kitchen, the Thai food kitchen, and then you go into the next kitchen, it's the Italian Indian food kitchen. And you kind of buy time there of 6 or 7 hours from like lunchtime till early evening. And you're assigned a table and you can go up and down and pick on whatever you like. Typical Irish people, like, you know, don't eat the bread now. Get the lobster.
Yeah.
You know, and at the same time, you're kind of going, how am I like really feeling the booze? Because I've only had this one glass and it's halfway down. And then you realize there's almost people hidden and they're just topping you up the whole time, your champagne glass. And so you have no idea when you leave. You're nearly rolled out of the place.
I nearly needed a Gaviscon just reading about it. Like the book, what is the book essentially about? Because we start with a body floating.
Yes.
But then there's this Irish family who appears very quickly.
Yes.
So can you give us a flavor of what you were...
As I said, the issue with... Like when Dubai works, it all seems to work very smoothly. So I really found my way into, because my background is short stories. So plotting a novel is a different thing. It's a different kind of form. And it needs to be strong enough to hold for a whole 70 or 80,000 words. And that was probably the biggest challenge of the book for me. And funny enough, when I was in Dubai, something clicked. It was about my third visit. I was like, this is very similar to how Victorian London used to be. And what I mean by that is, London in the 19th century was like the centre of innovation. It was cutting edge, but at the same time, very conservative, you know, mm-hmm. Victorian era. On top of that, this kind of complex relationship with morality, which on the surface is family values and all very clean. But then underneath it, this whole substrata of society of, you know, of sex workers and so on. And then the final thing was London was in the 19th century had this rich upper class and, a, you know, the class supporting them underneath. So these, it was
both
like
extremes.
It was like this fireworks went off in my head. And I was like, who's the great London writer? And it clicked, Charles Dickens. And out of that, my favourite Charles Dickens book is Our Mutual Friend.
Yeah.
And that book opens up with A Body Found in the Thames. And I went, I have the opening of my story. Now, there's no other comparison to the book, like storyline to that, other than The Body Found in the
Dickens
River.
Dickens didn't do the Christmas buffet, but if he did...
No. But that was how the novel started. I was like, okay, so there's a body in Dubai Marina. And then out of that, then I had a story. Because, I mean, I'm talking to you here about lots of themes and things like that. Mm. But I hope my reader just, if you're sitting in a hotel or on a beach somewhere, you can read this and be like, my dream for this book is someone falls in love with the characters I've written and really connects them. And then they go through hell and back with the characters and are sitting on the edge of their seat, gripped as everything falls apart. You know, I want that rising tension through the book.
So tell us about those characters, because they are really familiar to us, and particularly of that era in the recession, because you've got the kind of the older, the matriarch at home watching her kids disappear with the recession. And then you've got the young ones trying to make it in this shiny paradise.
Yeah. Well, Joan, for me, highlights something that we don't talk about, I think, enough in terms of Irish immigration, be it 2010 or 1980, which is we can talk about the economic situation. But what about all these families that are split up? You know, the family who are now, and I sometimes wonder, you know, like we don't talk about it enough, you know, of people, even with the maids in Dubai. I think of, you know, we kind of go, God, they have all these maids in Dubai and that's not great. But I'm like, most people have maids because they don't have the aunties and the grannies and the, you know, around them to kind of support. And so if you're a couple out there and you've children and you don't have an aunt or a grandparent or something to mind your child, you're going to need a maid. That's a necessity to have a night off, you know.
Yeah.
So I think Joan, for me, reflects that Irish situation that's been going on since the 19th century of the person left behind. And then in terms of Siobhan and Trevor, for me, they are my generation of Irish.
Yeah,
her
kids.
Yes. And they are in Ireland. Trevor especially is in Ireland and he's a personal trainer, but it's 2010. He's a kind of a minimum wage paying job. It's not going anywhere. And he feels like a total failure because he can't see any future in Ireland. At the same time, he has an uncle in Ireland who's Joan, his mother's brother, who didn't leave Ireland in the 80s when he could. And he's kind of this ghost haunting Trevor, kind of going like, if I stay, will I?
Yes.
He has alcohol issues and things like that. So Trevor, and then Trevor goes to Dubai. And in a way, he's our eyes as the reader to kind of see Dubai from both its good and bad side, because he notices the maids and the taxi drivers,
yes,
and that. But he also notices, well, I could have opportunity here. And what do? You stay put in Ireland without opportunity, or do you go somewhere and connect to a society that, you know, has flaws and you're not entirely comfortable with? It's kind of an impossible choice, if you know what I mean. So, yeah. And then I suppose thinking of Siobhan and the other kind of main Irish character as his sister, she's living in Dubai and has lived there for a few years, and she loves a bit of glam. She does, yeah. Like she does, and
that's putting it mildly.
Yeah,
she's big into it, isn't she?
And
you're almost saturated with brands and huge designer labels and so on.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a rich, diverse cast of characters here, mm, isn't there? And as you say, the maids and the taxi drivers are big characters in as well. But let's talk about Assam,
yes,
who we first meet in Dublin.
In Dublin, yes. So he's a gay Emirati. So he's kind of the reverse. He's actually well, you find out straight away in the book that he's essentially the brother of the girl who's died, and that brings him back to Dubai in the course of the book. And for me, I mean, I'm very careful when I think about, like, he's a gay man who's Muslim, and I don't want to speak for another culture's
sure,
experience.
Yes.
However, I'm a gay man who grew up in a extremely conservative environment. You know, my parents are Jehovah's Witnesses, and I think the conflict that Asim and I would face is exactly the same, of where it's just not accepted. You know, it's just, I think when I grew up, the way I'll say it was this, is the first thing I noticed was, being in a very conservative environment, there's the truthful answer and there's the right answer. So you end up in this relationship with your parents where you're giving them what they want to hear rather than how you actually feel.
Right.
And then that gradually, for me anyway, through my teens, which developed into a feeling of, I suppose I just didn't feel I was ever accepted by my parents fully, because I was gay, and it was this kind of constant approval seeking that then started to happen through school. And I just threw myself into school and was just trying to get better and better grades, because I think I was just waiting for that moment when everything would click. And Asim is the same as that. I think he's a smart guy. He's studying medicine in Dublin. He really wants to achieve something, but he has the wound that I think maybe a lot of gay people who maybe are in similar situations feel, which is they weren't quite the child their parent wanted, if you know what I mean. I don't know if that sounds...
Did you come out directly to your parents, or was it just sort of hovering?
I came out, actually, my parents, I was 19, and but I knew what it meant. I knew it was that was the end, essentially. That was the end of our relationship
In terms of contact?
Yeah.
That was obviously very difficult.
I
mean, a lot of us who grew up, obviously, in Catholic households, I didn't come out until I was 31. So, you know, I was just waiting for someone just to say, you know, what the truth was, and that I could relax. But like, it's never easy when it happens.
Mm.
When you're 19 and you suddenly find yourself alone, it wasn't easy.
Yeah, no, I would be honest. I definitely, around that sort of between maybe 17 and 24, firstly, I lived two lives for a while, which a lot of gay people do, even if it's not in such an extreme circumstance. And nothing will destroy your mental health like trying to live two lives. And you know, for me, it would have been trying to sort of, because being in, I suppose, a Jehovah's Witnesses, you're part of a community, and you don't have huge contact with people outside of that community, really, when you're in it. So leaving the religion is leaving everything, leaving your friends, it's a huge break. So I tried to, I suppose, have feet in both worlds for a while. And that was really, I mean, I was getting panic attacks and agoraphobia, and later kind of went through a period of depression, especially when I kind of came out the far side. But anyway, I suppose, bring it back to the book, that
this is energy, how you relate to this.
That's how I, you know, and so Asim is both smart and he's going to get somewhere in life, but there's this broken element of him that means that he's quite destructive behavior. You know, he's
living
too much.
The two lives.
He was living the two lives, exactly.
In your own case, are those issues resolved now?
They're resolved in that I've made peace with them. They're not resolved. I think the most damaging thing.
You can take
take
your time, and I don't want to push too much on this, because it's a good day for you that you've got the book out and everything. So you know, it's a joyous occasion. But you obviously had the relief initially when you got to come out. So you joined the world, essentially.
Yeah.
But you have some contact now, do you, with family?
Oh, I'm very close to other members. Like my siblings are incredible. And in fact, one of the things I loved most writing in the book was the relationship between Trevor and Siobhan, because that was just drawn straight from the loving relationship I would have with my siblings. I have two sisters and a brother who were all extremely tight.
Great.
My brother had a baby yesterday, and him and his girlfriend. So shout out to that. So that I was able to bring the warmth of all that. And actually, that's been the most healing thing of all, I'd say. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So those experiences obviously gave you that character. And I mean, he's living in that kind of difficult world, isn't he? Let's talk about Trevor, because we might recognise this character probably from sports stars who've talked about their mental health issues over recent years.
Yeah, I think Trevor is. I think we've moved on in 10 years compared to the Trevor in the book. It's 2010. And I think what's been amazing in the last 10 years is so many sports stars have come out and talked about their, you know, and kind of normalised, you know, their mental health issues. But Trevor, there's so much more going on in his head than he ever says. You know, it's, we don't realize the depth of, and I think, you know, we all know that, you know, we can all put on a smiling face going into work and we're not feeling that way, you know. So, but I think Siobhan sees him more clearly than anyone else. She, from young age, she, and there's a scene in the book, because the book only takes place over a week. It's, and I, that was really, I suppose, because I'm a short story writer, so that little tight time frame kind of suited me. But to kind of get the bigger picture, there's flashbacks to Siobhan kind of hunting off the bullies when he's younger and things like that. And she's constantly protective of him.
And he's got his own secrets.
He has his own secrets, yeah. So he has his own... I think when people have an element of maybe self-hatred or things they don't like about themselves, then that leads to kind of destructive behaviours, and that's what's kind of happened with him as well. He kind of almost needs the release of the built-up tension. So he makes, like in the book, he makes one or two choices that I certainly wouldn't be agreeable to. But I hope he's really, of anyone in the whole book, by the end of the book, I'm hoping he's the most changed. He's the person who's finally managed to get outside of his own perspective and see the world.
But we can recognise him because he's obviously, he's at a certain age, he's trying to get out of Ireland in 2010. He sees the promise of the riches of Dubai. But what's amazing is that he still has the draw home. Mm. And I mean your friends, that, because he went over to Dubai.
Yeah.
And I think you said somewhere that you've got friends kind of scattered around the world.
Yeah.
And they're still there, aren't they, around the place? What kind of countries are they?
Amsterdam, Paris, London, America, Australia. Like, I feel half my generation hasn't come back.
And do you think they will at this stage?
I know. I think because some of them bought properties, some of them have children, they've married there. I think their lives are settled there. And the one good thing about nowadays is Ryanair flights and all that. It's very easy to kind of get back and forth. But I do think that's maybe a cost we don't think of when we're thinking about kind of the recession and people moving, is the social cost of family and friends being apart. And that's big.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough one, but then they set down roots and it becomes a second home.
Yeah.
You stayed in Ireland despite everything.
I did. I was very lucky because I worked in publishing actually for a few years afterwards, and I got a job in a publishing house in Dublin, and I feel I maybe got the last job in Ireland before there was any jobs in publishing for about 3 or 4 years. I do actually feel very lucky that just things lined up in such a way. But I don't know if that hadn't come up, what would have been my next move, you know? So I suppose we can't know how that would work out. And we're here today.
Yeah. So 51551 is the text. Hi, Jamie's an interesting young man. We should remember that we couldn't wait to do exactly the same thing with luxury during the Celtic Tiger times. There was certainly no guilt felt. We were very comfortable with it. Plenty of fancy cars, cleaners and so on. There's a good point there, isn't there?
There is.
Embraced it.
Because I have a scene in Ireland where Joan actually goes to Rusborough House, quite deliberately so, because that's rich Irish people 60, 70 years ago, and they were well able to spend the cash.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? So I deliberately put that in because I was like, anything where I made a comment maybe about Dubai, I really tried to show something back in Ireland. Because I mean, a personal belief of mine is that there's a quote by that Roman playwright who says, I am a human being. Nothing human is alien to me. So to be aware that anything a human can do is within you. So I hope, I don't want to finger wag in this book. I just want to show it how it is. And hopefully, I'd rather people went away with kind of a sense of humanity and common humanity rather than a sense of, oh, Dubai is...
And you're not totally knocking a bit. Hi, Oliver, my niece is teaching in Dubai for the past 5 years. Her Instagram photos depict a non-stop partying lifestyle with colleagues every weekend. It seems fabulous. I mean, you have portrayed that as well as what's kind of happening underneath. And one of the most striking things actually was the dusty luxury cars in the airport that Trevor sees on his first visit. Tell us about those.
Certainly in the case in 2010 when the economic crash happened in Dubai, which is a case with many, I think, with many of the Middle Eastern countries, you just can't go bankrupt. It's not, it's actually a criminal offence. So if things go wrong, you just leave. Because it is it's an offence that could land you in serious trouble. So and they're very strict on kind of making sure your checks don't bounce and things like that. That they're it's a very strict culture that way. So at the time, definitely 2010. I don't know actually right now if that's still as strict as that, but definitely in 2010, the financial crash did hit Dubai, but they bounced back quite quickly from it. But when that financial crash hit, people left, and it is quite common seeing car parks there, cars with like, and you think, if I could just get them back to Ireland, I'd love that car. I'd love that Ferrari, but you know, they're just sitting there with an inch of dust on them, you know.
Yeah, so I think it's just such a visceral image of, you know, the kind of problems. There's a lot of love coming in for you here, I have to say. Great interview. I love this young man, Jamie, says a Tipperary mammy. And being a Cork man, you'll accept Tipperary praise. Jamie speaks so well about the difficulty for young people and the family expectations. Best of luck to him with his wonderful new book, Cats. Well, it's all about family secrets and everything. One thing I want to ask you, as a fan of the book, is that you leave us wanting more with some of the characters. Mm. It's not a spoiler to say that, but you don't neatly wrap everything up for some characters.
Yes. The reason for that, and I don't know if you noticed, the prologue and the epilogue start with the same sentence.
I didn't notice that. Okay.
And the reason being, reading. I just wanted this feeling of circular, that it's the new, the book ends with sort of the new, you know, Irish people arriving or leaving, and it all starts all over again. So the book that, and it, life isn't neat. I didn't feel it would be lying to the world I've created in this book to say there's a bow at the end of it. You know, it's not that. But
out of kilter with the style.
Yes.
Well done. You are great to tell a story for so many. Being accepted for who you are, such a fundamental need for every human, and the bittersweet story that is emigration, says Niamh. Good morning. Please repeat the name of your interviewee. Well, it's Jamie O'Connell and Diving for Pearls. We were never going to stop saying that. I'm a regular visitor to Dubai to my daughter and two grandchildren, says Pat Crowley, or it could be Crowley, depending on the part of the country he's from. And we'll end on this. What a fabulous young man being interviewed. He is wonderful in his honesty, even though his pain is clear. I'm looking forward to reading his book, says Fidelma. Well, your talent is clear as well, Jamie, and we wish you the best of luck. It's a great novel. Thank God I don't have to pretend. So thanks very much for that.
Jamie O'Connell, making Oliver Callan's life a little bit easier by writing a genuinely good book. The Citizens' Assembly has submitted its report on gender equality to the Oireachtas, and on Morning Ireland, Chair of the Assembly, Catherine Day, touched on some of the 45 priority recommendations made, starting with the much-debated Article 41 of the Constitution.
Well, the Constitution expresses the values and sets the framework for the kind of society we want to live in. And our Constitution was written in 1937. It's been amended since then. But Article 41 contains a clause which people usually describe as the woman in the home clause. And there are three constitutional changes that the Assembly is recommending. One is to delete that clause that refers to the woman and her work in the home, and to replace it by language that's not gender specific, but that would oblige the state to support, to take reasonable measures to support care in the home and the wider community. And this was a very strong call from the Assembly, I think influenced by the experience of everybody during COVID as well. So that's the first change. The second change is that our constitution gives a certain protection to the family, but only the married family. And as I think we all know, there are many, many kinds of families in Ireland now, not all of which are the result of marriage between a man and a woman. So the Assembly wants to have that protection for the family extended to all kinds of families. And then because, as I say, the Constitution projects your values, they also recommend introducing a clause that provides for gender equality and non-discrimination. So those would be three different changes to two articles of the Constitution if they are put to a referendum.
So any referendum then would involve a number of questions?
Well, that would be for the government to decide, but that's the recommendation from the Assembly, yes, that
and
there would be three different changes.
Has the government committed to holding a referendum?
What they have committed to is to take to give serious consideration to each recommendation and to respond to them. Now, they only got the report yesterday, so they need a bit of time. And the Oireachtas will set up a committee to go through all of the recommendations in the report and to react. But the Convention on the Constitution way back in 2012-2013 did already recommend changing the Woman in the Home clause. And the government of the day accepted that. But it never went to a referendum because I think they were not able to work out what to do about replacing it with wording on care.
As you mentioned care, and as you spoke there about maybe the role of carers coming to the forefront over the past year, there are several other recommendations about the position of carers in this document. It was clearly an issue that exercised the people taking part.
Yes. Well, I think what's very valuable about the Assembly is that citizens get access to factual information. They get information to what happens in other countries. They hear from advocacy groups and they also hear from people with their personal experience of working in care and being cared for. So I think a lot of them were surprised by what they learned about the relatively poor pay and conditions for people who do such an important job. And I think the COVID effect is that we have all realised how dependent we are on carers for the well-being and safety of the people that we love. So a lot of the recommendations go in the direction of giving better pay and conditions, including pensions, proper career structures to carers. And then also giving more choice to people who get long-term care, whether they are the elderly or people with disabilities. There's also very strong recommendations on childcare, because Ireland is a bit of an outlier in terms of other European countries. We have a largely private sector model, and the citizens in the Assembly voted very strongly for moving to a public sector model and for more spending, in particular on early years childcare.
These are huge issues, and various governments have grappled with them in the past. How much commitment, how much buy-in is there from the current government to what you're proposing?
Well, the Assembly was set up at the request of the Oireachtas, so the Dáil and the Seanad together, and they gave us a fairly detailed set of terms of reference. So the Assembly has now finished its work and it's responding back to the Oireachtas saying, you asked us to look into these issues, here's what we think. I think it will take the Oireachtas and the government some time to look at the recommendations. Some can be implemented fairly easily, but some will take more than a decade to deliver. But I think the message from the citizens is loud and clear that they want to see change start now.
Catherine Day chatting to Audrey Carville on Morning Ireland. There's a new series starting this weekend on RTE1 TV. Dermot Bannon's Super Small Spaces, or Generously Proportioned Family Homes, as they're called in Dublin. But seriously, the show highlights incredible creativity, and architect Dermot chatted about it all with Ray Darcy in the afternoon.
Now, you'll be delighted to hear that Dermot Bannon returns to our screens this evening and tomorrow evening and the evening after. No, no, I'm joking.
Why are you laughing, Ray?
No.
You're not supposed to laugh in an introduction. You're supposed to be bigging me up.
Oh, all right, sorry. Dermot Bannon, School of Broadcasting. Yeah.
Well, so, I do the rest of it.
No,
I?
You're okay. Okay. So it's Super Small Spaces.
Yes.
Dermot Bannon's Super Small Spaces.
Yes.
And it's Sunday night at 9:30. And that slot that you made your own with Room to Improve.
I don't know. We've two episodes. It's a little bit of a mini series. The first one is probably going to be a scorcher of a bank holiday weekend. Nobody will stay in.
Right.
And the following one is the one where we're all let out.
Okay.
So I don't know if anybody, but if anybody cares, if anybody is stuck in and they can't get out, it's something to watch on the television.
Well, I watched it last night.
Did you enjoy it?
Preview copy. I really enjoyed it. It's really different. And the first one, that lovely McCarthy family that we spoke to on the show, They're making a converting a double-decker bus into Airbnb.
Yes.
And you're helping them.
Well, I think when you spoke to them, you spoke to them at the start of their journey, and it was very much about their dad.
Yes.
and all that. And I thought when I went to meet them, it would be kind of pull on the heartstrings and it'd be lots of that. My God, I was so wrong. Yes, they do want to pull on the heartstrings and it is very emotional, but I've never met a family who are better crack.
Yeah.
So the journey was chaos. It was absolute chaos.
I've never seen as much colour. Like there's colour everywhere.
And I banished about half of that before. They had a pink front door going into it at one stage. Yeah. That didn't make the cut. Yeah. Like we had so much stuff. We could have made an actual episode about the bus, but that's not what it was about. We thought we were supposed to go down for one visit, have a chat with them, see what they're doing. And we fell in love with them so much. We said, we'll go back. Look, we'll come back at the end. And they said, you know, we should probably go back in the middle. So it's like a little mini room to improve.
Throughout
the thing where
it's a spine.
We didn't think it was going to be that. It was on the sheets, you know, when you start into a TV program, you've loads of different options. And they were just, oh, we'll do one visit, and I was there. Yeah. A bus? Seriously, guys, it's not even a building. When I got to meet them, like they were just brilliant.
Brilliant.
So for me, I think what really got me as well was it was the bus is brilliant, and I'm not going to give any spoilers how it turned out at the end. But also, like they went, like I'm sure listeners know, but like their dad tragically took his own life on the 1st of May last year. And what they did is they used this as a project to kind of to take their minds off things, you know. And rather than sitting drinking endless cups of tea, are you all right, ma'am? I'm okay. Are you all right, Rachel? Are you okay? They didn't. They just got stuck into it and had a bit of crack with it. And it's a great watch.
And even if people are out on Sunday night, I'm sure people will talk about it and they'll come back to it on the player.
Hopefully.
Yeah. It is one of those moments in television, I think.
Do you think?
Oh, yeah. I think people are going to fall in love with them.
It's hard not to.
Yeah.
But we've other stories in it too.
Yes,
so it's a bit of a smattering of stuff. And I think the idea for the show.
And was that Kildare Town? Is he the brewer guy? Is he in Kildare Town?
He is. He's, no, not in Kildare Town. Nace.
No,
sorry,
Nace.
Sorry, Kildare. No, so you're wrong. No, sorry. He is in Kildare Town. Do you not see the big sign when you come into Kildare Town?
Yes, I know.
Town?
That's
the family.
Yes, that's
home.
The family. But,
and so it's in behind that. Yes. So
how would you describe that house to people? It's sort of
experimental. So basically, he went about trying to design a house that he could build himself, a kit house. So lots of kit houses are a great idea, but they need cranes, they need lorries, So he said, can I make a kit house that I can put into the back of my car? And so it was designed around this arc. So the whole thing kind of slots together like a piece of jigsaw, but it's all done in small, manageable pieces, and it's very sustainable because of what he's using, the timber that he uses and the materials.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, I knew him before, but I knew him as a furniture designer. I didn't, and he kind of, he had this idea in his head for the last 15 years. I think he designed the sculpture, if anybody knows, the entrance into the Mater Hospital.
Right.
Into the new Mater Hospital. He designed sculpture there. So this is his first ever building project. And he decided during lockdown, right, I have this idea in my head, I'm going to just go and do it. And it was really cool inside. It was like being inside an aircraft wing.
So he did it during lockdown?
All by himself. Oh, he was wrecked by the time we got there. So, because he had been working on it for the year, and I suppose he knew we were coming down to film, and he that gave him the momentum. Right. So he pushed.
You're having a busy year because Room to Improve returns in the autumn.
It does. I suppose, when you say that it returns, I'm on it now, and we're in the really busy stage now where all the jobs are in sight. Because the first five months of the year, there was nothing really happening. Okay. We were going in for planning permission. We were sorting out all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then as soon as the sites opened, all of them went. It's never happened before. Normally in Room to Improve, one starts in sight, 2 weeks later, another one starts in sight. So if you're doing six projects, that's over 12 weeks. They all happened over 12 hours.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. Of course.
For me.
You've been on Claireborn. You've been asked questions about the housing crisis.
Yeah.
We're back in the thick of it again.
Yeah.
Well, we never got out of it, really, but it just wasn't in the headlines. So do you have one silver bullet, one brilliant idea that would solve the housing crisis?
It's supply. Like the whole reason we're in this mess is we just do not have enough houses. The population is growing and we're not building enough. And I suppose if there's one silver bullet, like we do have, there's a lot of vacant properties. I think there is 180,000 vacant properties up and down this country.
Mm.
And I think if we did something to help people, like a lot of them will need work and they may need, conservation officers, fire officers, if we can, and they just take an endless amount of time to get through the system. So if maybe you help us, you want to do things properly. Like the housing crisis is not going to be solved in 2 years' time. It is going to take 15 years, whether we like it or not, right?
Right.
And
but isn't that a problem then? Because politicians are worried
about
the next 5 years.
It's a problem whether we like it or
not. But they're worried about is getting re-elected.
Exactly. So they want to do a big scheme. They want to say, oh, we've put 4,000 units in tomorrow. Yes. And they love the idea of doing pods and all of that. Look, do you know something? Over the last few years, I've worked on a couple of different innovative housing things and all of that. And any politician I've met, their interest is there. It's just there's so many different components to it.
So many moving parts.
Yeah, there's developers, there's banks, there's financiers, there is the government, all of the housing bodies, and they all need to sing off the one hymn sheet. And it's a massive... And this problem has been getting progressively worse and worse and worse. And our population is growing and growing and growing. The gap is wide. But if we put our kind of neck next to it, we can get it done in the next 15 years, but it's going to take that long.
Okay.
And you're right, nobody's going to take credit for it then.
Yeah. Yeah. But go back to the programme on Sunday night, because you see this lovely place in Kilrush. It's a converted...
It was brilliant,
pub.
Yeah. Converted. And I have a bit of a soft spot for small Irish towns. Both my parents were... My dad was from the country, he's from Dungarvan. My mum is from Wexford. She's from just outside New Ross. And I just think we have some beautiful Irish towns. And I've been really lucky on Room to Improve to travel up and down. And like, you spend a year in places like Fermoy and all that. And like, I think coming over that bridge into Fermoy and you get the square. Yeah. And yet all the buildings on it are empty and all.
So what's the solution to that now, for
just
example?
Just incentivising people to get back into towns. Like, we do have to have a bit of a shift in our mindset as well, in that people want to live in towns. You grew up in a rural town, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is, getting the plot 5 miles outside of town, getting yourself an acre and building a one-off house. If we can get people...
It's never an aspiration I had, but anyway.
Lots of people do, because if they grew up in a town, they say they wanted to live in a bigger house. And there's no problem with that. But we have to build our towns and make them vibrant so that people will want to live.
But what about, like, just let's get quite specific here. Yeah. What about shop units? Because whether we like it or not, they're going to remain empty because people... Yeah. And lockdown has accelerated the online shopping thing.
Yeah.
So unfortunately,
people can live in them. And there is some amazing spaces. Like, a lot of the old towns are Victorian towns or even Georgian towns. And so there's lovely tall ceilings, nice big rooms. They can quite easily be converted into houses. Then what you have is, if there's enough people living on the square, a coffee shop will pop up.
Yes.
And then a little bakery will pop up because people will demand it, or they'll see a niche.
And the ultimate thing is that they'll breathe life back into
towns. If you
towns
see towns where they've done it, where they've made a really concerted effort, places like Clonakilty, places like Westport, where they've...
You've picked two ones that are not the norm,
But other towns can aspire to it.
Yeah, but like Clonakilty is just there. It has Inchidani out the road.
And Westport is the same. If we have a population...
It's easy to cite those.
No, it is. And you're right. Yeah. But if we have a population who are now moving back to rural towns, and there's an incentive for them there, like in Kilrush, everybody was chatting about the amount of people who've moved back down home because they can work from home and they're working for big multinationals.
Wouldn't it be great to see them then populate the main streets?
Yeah, and populated by people who want to move back home, who are part of a local GA club, who've got family there. Yeah. Lots of people move to Dublin, Limerick, Waterford, not really by choice. It's because of work.
I was watching the 6 o'clock news last night, and Katrina Perry was broadcasting from the Europe Hotel in Killarney.
Yeah.
And she spoke to a lady, can't remember the lady's name or the man, but the man was the head of the Chamber of Commerce in Tralee.
Yeah.
And he did what I thought was the oddest thing ever. He did this sort of ad for Kerry.
Did he?
For people to come and work. He was doing remote working. His realness here to stay. Why not come to Kerry?
Yeah.
we're lovely down here.
A lot of people are really considering that. They're thinking, right, if I can do my job at home, right, it means I can literally move anywhere in Ireland. I can live beside the sea. I can live beside the mountains. Wherever, like, our hobbies have become hugely important to us over lockdown, what we do. And then people want to go to the nicest place to do that. And it might mean a trip to Dublin, Limerick, Cork, Waterford once a week or twice a week to go to a meeting. But I think flexible working is going to be here to stay.
Wouldn't it be great if that was, a legacy of the lockdown?
I think it would be amazing.
Yeah, and breathe life back into small towns all over the country.
And small towns are very, very strong communities, and they're held together with GAA clubs, as I said before, and things like that. And a lot of people who move out of them don't really, and I know lots of people who go home every weekend or they're travelling up and down.
So what you say, they don't really want it, but they have to go where the work is. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think if there was a vibrant community and if there was people there and they could do their work and see family and have support network and somebody to mind the kids in the afternoon and all of that, I think that's what people want.
So in not to give away any spoilers or anything, but in Room to Improve, when eventually comes back in the autumn.
Oh, there's no spoilers in that because they're not done.
All right. Is there, have people changed their mind? You know, have you got any examples of people working from home and changing the layout?
Everybody's working from home.
Right.
So home office is becoming a big thing. Storage, utility rooms, they're a big thing because people are kind of noticing clutter and mess and all that in their houses. So they're all, and we've won.
Oh, that's interesting. So people are looking around now because they're not going out to work.
They're not as focused on having the big table to entertain 25 people anymore.
Yes, yes.
They're more focused on, I just can't look at this clutter anymore. I can't bear it.
Right, so you have a minute now.
A minute now.
For people, just because people are still having problems with working from home and the office and all that sort of thing. What are your top tips for that?
Oh, for the home office, I think move it into the nicest space in your house because the nicest, brightest space. Most people work 8 hours a day. It's normally during daytime hours.
Yes.
If there's a bedroom that you're sleeping in and it's got lovely bright sunshine and there's a back bedroom that you go into because that's where the home office is, swap them over.
Right.
You know, just put yourself into a place
that's going to lift. It's 8 hours, yeah.
Yeah, and lift your... It's going to be where you're going to be spending most of your time and put it into a nice room that you're going to enjoy going to. So you can bring up your cup of coffee in the morning, the sun is shining in and it gives you a bit of a lift. You're not thinking, Jesus, I'm at home again today.
Well, that could be our new national motto after the past 15 months. Dermot Bannon on The Ray D'Arcy Show. Now, I may not have included any of today's lifeline, but I'll let Oliver Callan do the honours instead.
You know, we all know this.
51551, wash your hands.
That was the original and best. Joe Duffy.
51551, wash your hands.
From the 13th of March 2020 was the first time he said it. And he said it every time since. 51551. 51551, we'd say here. But Joe had a little announcement yesterday. You almost would miss it if you weren't paying sharp attention. But we pay very, very close attention to what's happening on the live line.
Joe at RT.ie, 51551, wash your hands. I'll stop saying that soon, I think, now that the lockdown is over. I'll say that for the last time. What day is today? I'll say that for the last time next week and hopefully people have got the message.
So we don't know exactly when the last one, wash your hands. Because we were discussing it the other day and it's become a sort of shh hands. Or you might have hands. But what would he say? What will Joe be saying after this?
51551, wash your hands.
51551, have that pint, suggests Crossy on Twitter. 51551, eat that cake. 51551, meet that friend. Pick up the litter. Fence off that park. No, don't fence. Lift the fences. That's a full lifeline issue there. So I hope I didn't offend poor Joe and now he's got this insecurity. Joe doesn't have insecurities about 51551, wash your hands.
Say it ain't so, Joe. Anyway, listeners had plenty of their own suggestions.
This texter says, replace wash your hands, this is Joe's wash your hands, with 51551, wash those bands, giving an impetus to the arts and musicians in the industry, says Enda. Yes, I was talking to someone in the live entertainment industry and there is a buoyant mood out there, hopefully.
And another one. We've become a nation obsessed with giving hugs, whether made from paper or not. So it continued.
How about Joe saying 51551, give a hug, says Denise. And she has kisses in her messages, so she's getting a bit carried away with herself. But then, of course, he'd have to kind of do terms and conditions. Give a hug, terms and conditions apply. You have to be double vaccinated. Both people have to be double vaccinated. Don't be giving hugs. Wash your hands, wash your arms, your knees and toes, fingers, knees and toes.
And on that note, I'm going to say goodbye. So wash those hands, watch those bands, give a hug. Regardless, thanks for listening.